install each connector. And if I had the right kind of crimping tools and preparation tools, that whole process could be done with 1 minute and maybe even a little bit less. But here's my philosophy on that. The old and the tried and true old technique of a well-installed UG21 type N connector or PL259 properly installed with a 10-minute investment. I don't build that many connectors for my shack. I'm willing to do the 10-minute investment knowing that there's a high probability that that piece of cable will survive outdoors and give me very little trouble for 10 solid years. I'm willing to make a 10-minute investment to have 10 years of longevity of that cable in an outdoor environment. Whereas the crimp connector is going to save me the 9 minutes, but maybe the connector is only going to be good for 4 years outdoors before it gives me trouble. From my point of view, that's not a good investment, because when I put things on the tower, I want to own that equipment on the tower. I don't want it to own me. I don't want me to have to go up there and do periodic maintenance of reestablishing the weather seal and painting and weather and putting galvanizing and whatever. I want to own the equipment. I don't want it to own me. So I'm willing to make that extra investment. I'll admit if I was running a business and I've got to install 15 connectors per day, I'll admit my thinking would be very different. Now I would be guaranteeing the performance of the electronics outdoors for the next 4 years. Beyond that, it would be beyond the warranty period, and it would no longer be my responsibility, and I get the maximum profit for doing that. You can see where we're going here. N2EO.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
N2EO, K2LIW. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick and Mel. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this works out. Like I say, the SWR is very, very good, with over 100 watts out and seeing about 2 watts back. On 2 and 432, I use, similar to what Mel is talking about, the UG21 type connector. The sensor pin crimps on separately, and then it slips into the connector. And what I liked about these particular connectors, Dick, I've had experiences with cables like LMR 400 where when you use a compression connector, like a UG21, it tends to loosen up in a period of time because it keeps bearing down on that foam dielectric on the cable. These connectors have a, I guess you call it a ring, or not a collet, but a ring, that's, when you slip the shell on, it goes under the braid, but over the foil, and then the collet goes on over the rubber jacket, so when you crimp it down, there's a rigid piece of metal between the shield and between the braid. You know what I'm talking about, Dick. That's the problem I've run into with the UG21s on that type of cable. Let's see how it holds up. So far, it looks good. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW and 2EO.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to check with you periodically to find out how well that's all holding up, Rich. 100 watts coming out of your transmitter and 2 watts coming back sounds extremely good. When you do the actual calculation, that's a 17 dB reflection coefficient, that's a standing wave, a calculated standing wave ratio in the shack of 1.33 to 1. Very good, but not perfect. A naive person would say, gee, only 2 watts coming back, 2% of the power coming back. Bear in mind now the standing wave ratio is defined as voltage, so you have to take the square root of that ratio, 2 to 100, and you end up with 0.141. In other words, 14.1% of the voltage you're sending out is coming back. Very good. Every transmitter that you and I own is going to be happy with a no-tune transmitter with a 1.33 standing wave ratio. So, fun stuff. Let's find out how well that stands up, and with you and Barry doing the weatherproofing, I trust it. But unless an experienced person has put on the coaxial heat shrink tubing or whatever, getting water in a cable at VHF and UHF frequencies can give you a tremendous amount of loss and grief downrange. And so we got to fight very hard to keep water out of our coaxial connectors, out of our antenna interface, out in the weather. Let's see if Alan is there. KC2RFN, Alan, well, wait a minute now. Let's go over to Mel's mailbag. K2KEY, what kind of burning questions have we received this week, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, let me pause, see if anybody else wants to get in from the outline area. Okay, let me make a couple of statements first, Dick. I'm going to paraphrase and, what Eric said. Quite a number of emails that sort of, as I say, more or less said similar to what Eric a few minutes ago brought up. So I didn't want to really bring that up, but being that Eric sort of exposed it, I just have to say I've gotten similar emails. Let me drop. Okay, as far as connectors go, last word on them. I've had plenty of stuff I salvaged from World War II. Cables with BNCs on them. Cables with PL259, end connectors, you know, all that terrific stuff. You look at the old stuff of World War II, you know, what Amphenol produced. And they were just, you know, well-made, silver-plated stuff. You take them apart, of course, they were put together the old-fashioned way. Everything was more or less soldered up, and still they were still had perfect integrity, beautiful still, with all the who knows where they were and how they were stored. The cable itself may have been, you know, dried up and shot, but the connectors and the connections there was definitely A-okay. All right, anything you want to say before I continue? Over.
Yeah, let me since you're a major person of this group, Mel, if we reverse the order, if we handle everyone's questions during the first hour, then go over to the mailbag for a reasonable length of time, then into the more deep subjects, similar to what John and Wesley are involved in, do you believe that would be a more acceptable way? In other words, if we reverse the order in which we do things, discuss the deeper subjects later, hopefully the people who want to go that deep are willing to stay up that late. And for those who can't stay up that late, they do have the option of listening to the recording at amateurradio.tv and fast-forwarding through the sections they don't want to hear and listen to the section they do want to hear. So if we reverse the order, do you think that will create greater happiness among among the whole crew involved? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I think we give it a try, Dick. I think it may work because we do have young audience. I told you many times that they usually leave us 10 o'clock and the latest. And also, if you'll notice a number of times that we then ask for, you ask for people that signed in initially when we opened the net and they are not there because I guess they just can't bear with it past a certain time. I guess there are people also going to work that also have to get to bed, you know, at a reasonable time. Maybe their cutoff time is around maybe 11 o'clock because they have to get up at wee hours in the morning. So I think maybe we'll give it a try next week, Dick, and see how it works out. I'll get the feedback, I'm sure, over.
Okay, we're going to try that next. Go right ahead with the questions you received, Mel.
Hey, just reading over a couple of ones. Okay, here's one that's interesting. A few weeks ago, you may have remembered I asked you about stringing a dial cord on an old receiver. Well, I got the dial cord like you suggested, and I was able to string it. Worked out real well. Unfortunately, I had to remove a tube from the socket. When I took it out, the center little black piece that guides the tube correctly into the socket broke. Is there some way I could figure out how to put this tube back in the socket? The tube number is 6 Victory 6, 6V6. Go ahead, Dick.
Yes, to my knowledge, 8-pin tubes, the little black keyway in the center, because that keyway only allows the tube to be plugged into the socket with one particular orientation, it forces all the pins to go in there correctly. The 8 pins that come out of the bottom of that tube, if you look at them bottom view, you'll see there is a gap in the pins. And the socket also has a gap in the spacing of where the pins go. So even without that keyway, although it's more difficult to find the correct orientation of the tube, even if you don't want to spend the time gluing that keyway back on, I still think you stand a good chance of plugging the tube in correctly if you look at it carefully and go slowly. I've done that, Mel, and I think, and for instance, the ultra-miniature tubes, the more miniature tubes, the 7-pin and 9-pin tubes, don't even have a keyway. Because of the gap, there's only one way they go. But even on the 8-pin tubes with the keyway, there is a gap, and as such, I don't think you can seat the tube correctly if you get the orientation wrong, as long as you go slow enough not to be bending those pins. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
It's working.
Let's see what Rich has got. I mean, and, go ahead, my mind's going blank. You got it, Lou.
Okay, didn't know if I'd get in there before, Mel. I actually had a very entertaining experience with that back in high school. With an 11-pin connector with a plastic key at the center, and it was the scoreboard cable connector, and when somebody kicked it out of the wall, the game had to stop, and nobody could figure out how to put it back. The pins were all bent. And I was able to look at it and just place them back in and they could resume play. So the same thing with the tubes. I have an announcement for the net whenever you have a chance. Thank you, Dick. Send to RQ.
Okay, so once you bent the pins back and put it back together carefully without just jamming it like a gorilla, so to speak, normal performance was restored. Go ahead with your announcement, Lou.
Okay, we have a meeting of the chemistry teachers and physics teachers clubs next Friday evening at NYU, and I thought the topic might be of interest to people on the net. It's, and I don't have the detail in front of me, it's about the some late information on what's happening with AC versus DC. And I forgot who the associate professor is speaking. The meeting is at 7:15 at NYU in Manhattan, and the meetings are free and open. Anybody wants details, they can contact me at N2RQ at ARRL.net. Back to you, Dick. N2RQ.
Sounds like an exciting meeting. It sounds like the price is right. Sounds like there's some real integrity there and some real information is going to be transmitted. The subject, though, is a little bit unclear to me, Lou. AC versus DC is what you said. Now, you could be talking about high power, long-range power distribution. Not distribution. Is it distribution? In other words, the way you transport high power 1,000 miles, for instance, from a hydro station in northern Canada down to, let's say, New York State, there might be 800 miles you have to traverse, and that long-range transmission, if you do it with DC versus AC, there's some significant advantages in the efficiency and the lack of vulnerability of Earth's magnetic field effects and corona effects from the sun and so on. However, it's a little bit more complicated when it comes to converting the half million volts of DC back into 60 cycle AC. So is that the DC versus AC you're talking about? Long range power transmission. N2RQ, K2RIW in the deck net.
Well, to be honest, not sure. I suspect it's certainly going to be touched on. One of the things, 100 years ago, we had the AC versus DC war between Edison and Westinghouse and Tesla. And a lot of people think that was all settled. But in fact, the changes in inverter technology and things like that have shifted things around. So yes, there's high voltage, long distance transmission. There's also a lot of stuff, hybrid cars, a lot of stuff. And I honestly don't know the detail, which is one of the reasons I'll be attending.
Once again, how soon is that meeting, and will we have some time between now and then to get a little bit more definition of what the subject matter is? And the school I went to, Pratt Institute, had on station for lots and lots of years, essentially 100 years worth of DC power generation that went over to all the engineering buildings. Well, Pratt Institute no longer has an engineering school, much to my disappointment. So maybe for the first time in 100 years, the DC power generating station is no longer operational. Over to you, Lou. How soon will it be for that talk? You told me, and I didn't write down the date.
Okay, while you were speaking, Alice found the announcement. So I can read the little bit that I have. First of all, it is next Friday evening, so no more nets between now and then. The speaker is Joseph J. Cunningham, adjunct professor of railway systems at TCI College of Technology, New York City. The topic is the myth of the war of the currents, AC versus DC. And I'll read the whole blurb. It's very short. Legend depicts the origin of the electrical age as a titanic struggle between the direct current electrical system of Thomas Edison and alternating current favored by George Westinghouse and Nikola Tesla. In reality, however, both systems have advantages and limitations. In the short-term hybrid systems developed while 12 decades later, direct current still has significant and increasing application. Then and now, the selection was and is dependent not on rhetoric, but on engineering practicality and economic feasibility. That's about all I have, except for directions. Dick. By the way, did you get the email I sent to you yesterday with a link? This is N2RQ.
Yes, I did, and I've seen that one once before. This is a man climbing a 1,700-foot high tower with a camera on his head. Exciting-looking material. Reminds me a little bit of climbing my tower, which is a extremely small fraction of that. All right, this coming up Friday, I think you said. In what location, at what time, one more time, Lou, will be this AC versus DC discussion and lecture?
Okay, the location that we normally give is NYU 32 Waverly Place. It's the Silver Center, which used to be called the Main Building, right near Washington Square Park. And it's in room 207. At 7:15 p.m.
Very good. 7:15 p.m., Main Building, room 207, NYU, 32 Waverly Place, and the subject of AC versus DC. Thank you for that information, Lou. Mel, go right back with your mailbag questions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, saw that also, that video. The guy climbing a tower. My friend George, Pennsylvania, sent it to me. He knows the guy that actually made it. That's where it started with. Where was I? What were we talking about? Oh, the 6v6. All right, let's go through this without going off on a tangent, because that's another thing. I've gotten a lot of emails that we start something but don't ever continue it, and it's always continued in pieces. So we're gonna have to do a little bit of changes in the TechNet, leave any announcements at the beginning, opening the TechNet, and then when we get on to a subject, discuss it correctly, briefly, whatever it is, and then go on to another subject, because it's too many comments I'm getting that I could say that they're not very happy with the format that we've been going through as of the last, well, what we've sort of gotten into in the last months, and Eric has more or less confirmed it. Okay, the 6V6, let's stay with that. The 6V6 was an audio I know it quite well, used very popular in all the receivers. Let me let it drop, so I'll start again. Okay, 6V6 was an audio output tube, very popular in the old receivers. Many of them used that as the standard tube, also in the TV sets as audio output. It was an 8-pin tube. Now, the pin 6, yes, as Vic says, is missing, but it's not missing on the socket of the radio. They all, because the sockets were standard 8 pins, and some sockets, you know, some tubes use that 6 pin. However, listen carefully, if you take the tube, and you will find next to that missing pin, going, if you look at the tube on the bottom, that was facing up you to you, the pins. The pin, the shape, that pin that is right after the missing pin, that pin is pin number 7, number 7. If you count backwards now, 7, 6, 5, 4, in other words, you do count the missing pin. You go back to number 2, and with your meter, if you measure, you'll see that you'll get by a resistance with your VOF. Let me let it drop. You'll get a resistance. Now, what you do is make a little mark with a magic marker on the side of the tube, marking pin number 7 and pin number 2. Now, being that you got the receiver apart, on the bottom of the chassis, if you look at the socket very carefully, you may have to look at it with a light or even with a magnifying glass. When I was young, I didn't need a magnifying glass. I used to be able to see all those things. You'll see pin 2 and pin 7 marked right on the ceramic. They always printed it into the ceramic. Now, what you do is just follow that up to the top. Make a little mark next to pin 2 and pin 7 as you look at it from the bottom. Make the mark now on top. Now line up the pin 2 number that you marked on the tube, and the number was 7. Put the tube in that way, and you'll see the tube will light up. If the tube lights up, you know you've got it in right. That's the best advice I can give you. I'm sure you can easily do it. Any comments? Go ahead, Dick.
So, I wasn't familiar with the fact that there's a missing pin on the socket of the tube. I thought an 8-pin tube really has, an octal tube as it's called, really has 8 pins, and there is a gap between pin number 1 and pin number 8, and that's where the key of the keyway on that black center object, which forces you with one particular orientation to plug the tube in. I thought the gap was between pins number 1 and 8. You might also indicate, Mel, when you're looking at the tube held in your hand, bottom view, you're looking at the pins. Are the pins counted in a clockwise direction or a counterclockwise direction? When it comes to 2 and 7, it almost doesn't matter. But still, a person might want to know, are they counted clockwise or counterclockwise? And are there other missing pins of a 6V6 tube other than the pin that doesn't go where the keyway is, so that there are 8 pins that are coming out of the bottom of the tube? K2KEY, K2RIW.
On that type of octal tube, the pins are all equally spaced. The 6V6, I happen to remember so well, Dick, you know, God knows how many numbers of my handled, you know. It was, like I say, every TV set just about, all the original, you know, 630 RCAs and everything. That was the audio alpha tube. It was the audio alpha tube and the old receivers, every one of them. So, it, like you say, the keyway, but remember, the pins were equally spaced all around. But they did leave off pin number 6. I don't know why. They just never put it in. That was the way they made that tube. And if you look at the tube with the pins sticking up at you, you count clockwise, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So when you look at that, you the pin clockwise next to the next one after the missing pin, that clockwise book. That's pin number 7. And if you go from that to counting counterclockwise going backwards, you'll go 7, count number 6, the missing one, 5, 4, 3, to number 2. That's the other end of the filament. Over.
So that particular tube, pin number 2 and 7, are filament. You'll measure a small number of ohms with your ohm meter when you're making direct contact to the pins of the tube. When you look at the bottom of the chassis, you'll see the heavy wiring that gives you 6.3 volts. In fact, you can turn on the amplifier. You can turn on the whole circuit without the tube plugged in. Nothing bad happens. And you can confirm that between pins 2 and 7, you'll measure something like 6.3 volts AC. Got to be a little bit careful now. If you hit the wrong pins with your probes from your volt-ohm milliammeter, you may hit the pin that has 150 volts intended for the plate. So, but the filament wiring tends to be a characteristic color on the bottom of the chassis, letting you know which wires are supplying the 6.3 volts. They tend to be a heavier wire. On some chassis, the filament wiring are wires with either green insulation or a green stripe. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think as Mel was alluding to, you know, and the filaments always are, you know, something very, very close to a very low impedance, very, very low ohms compared to most of the other pins. But I think also in the socket itself, the filament, its complementary pins in the socket are going to be like a transformer. So if the thing is unplugged and you've got a tube in your hand, you should be able to take an ohm meter and find out which two pins, because of the low impedance of the filament in the tube, and then be able to use an ohm meter again back into the tube socket and be able to find the filament winding of the filament transformer, which is also usually a pretty good indication, because that's very low impedance as well. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment, Dick?
Yeah, John recognized. Excellent suggestion. With the amplifier turned off, you can easily recognize the two filament pins on the socket of the chassis, because that secondary winding giving you 6.3 volts will be very close to 0 ohms. My guess is with your ohm meter, you'll measure something in the vicinity of half an ohm between those two pins of the chassis, and you'll know that those are pins 2 and 7, the filament wire. In the case of the tube itself, the two filament pins are going to be a couple of ohms. On some tubes, you've got to be a little bit careful, because they may have one pin of the filament and one pin of the cathode inside the tube connected together. They will be 0 ohms. So you'll know you've got the filament pins on the tube when you measure 1 or 2 ohms. And you'll measure very close to 0 ohms of the two filament windings pins on the chassis because of that very low impedance transformer when everything is turned off. I wonder if you've used techniques like that, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yes, Dick, I sure have. But in reality, from all my experience with the octal bases, even when the guide pin breaks off, if you look at the base carefully enough, you can see exactly where the key is. Then you can put your felt tip marker on the tube and just set it down where the slot is. It makes it a lot easier.
From your recollection, John, I think there's a gap between pin number 1 and pin number 8. That's where the keyway is. And Mel is telling us there's an additional missing pin, which I think he said is pin 6, which gives another gap when you look at those pins on the bottom of a 6V6. Over to you for any comment on that, John.
No, Mel is correct. They're all separated by the same distance. There's no gap at the key entrance. I don't remember that. All the octal tubes had linear spacing. And yeah, there was several tubes that had pins missing. It wasn't only the 6V6, but it was confusing because you would think, novices would think the pin broke off. But good tube to the 6V6. I liked it, along with the K6.
Yeah, I think a 6V6 has in the vicinity of 25 watts of plate dissipation, so as an audio output tube, it can give you a healthy amount of audio. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, very good. Yes,
on. Right, yeah. All the old timers, we remember that. Another usual thing that they did with the filament pins on the bottom, the two filament pin wires, as Dick says, usually were green, sometimes with a stripe. One had a stripe in it. But they usually were twisted together also. For some reason, they always twisted the two 6.3 filament pin wires together from one tube sock to another. I think that was mostly because of the assembly practice, but it seemed like that was commonplace in almost all those old receivers. I'm sure worked and had enough number of them apart. And, yeah, the... yes, I should say they were usually running upwards of, I think the Class A amplification of them were just for passing was around 12 to 15 watts of plate dissipation. And they were also used, also I could say extensively in television sets. Some use them even as vertical amplifiers, but all right, let me not get off the subject. So you're looking for pins, as everybody says. The two pins on the tube, the only two pins that are going to have what we call continuity. Let me let it drop. That means if you have the meter on R times 1, you're going to see a resistance between only two pins, the filament pins. Nothing else, no matter any other combination you make, you're going to see anything on R times 1 on your VOM. So like I say, once you mark off, find the missing pin. That's number 7. That'll tell you where to begin. That's number right after the missing pin is number 7. Count backwards to 2. Look on the bottom. You'll see most likely easily you're going to spot those two pair of twisted wires and the number on the socket. So carefully do that. You can put it in and all. Sometimes you can spot the where the key, how the keyway broke, but if you want to be sure. Why I'm telling you to do this is with the power off, because, you know, if you're going to crawl in there and the power is on, remember, there is B+. This is not a solid-state radio. This thing had B+, and the there was at least somewhere around 275 to 300 volts on the plate pin of that tube. So if you're going to go into the radio with it on, careful. Don't get knocked on, you know. Okay, parents may not be very happy then that we're telling you about these things. Okay, Dick, anything else there before, or you'd like to try one more?
Yeah, we're definitely going to try one more. Not looking for that one. The reason the two wires to the filament are twisted together, Mel, is two reasons. One, standard practice, you can easily recognize the filament wiring, is the secondary reason. The primary reason is humbucking. The filament wiring of a tube-type radio has the highest current of any of the wiring in that chassis. Therefore, the strongest amount of magnetic field exists around all of those wires. By twisting them together, they become a shielded, twisted pair, and whatever magnetic field created by the wire number one is canceled by almost the identical current flowing back on wire number two with filament wiring. So when you twist them together, you stop the magnetic field from radiating from those wires. If you didn't do that, if you conveniently laid out the wiring in ways that minimize the amount of wire on the chassis, the strong magnetic field on the filament wiring would eventually be picked up by the audio circuits and give you hum coming out of the loudspeaker. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2WIE.
Mr. WIE. Go ahead, Eric.
Good evening, Dick and Mel and fellow technetters. I'd just like to associate myself with the very thoughtful and sincerely delivered remarks by Eric regarding the distribution of TechNet time. And to your credit, Dick and Mel, the objective way in which you received it.
Okay, another vote recognized to Eric, and I thank you. So it looks like the majority of the votes are saying that the heavy material should be held later, and the quicker answered material should be sooner, because many of those people want to go to sleep. And I know Wesley wants to go to sleep also. His wife wants him to keep up with his beauty rest. So there's a little bit of a conflict here, but okay, we're going to honor these suggestions. Go ahead with the next one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, your Dick is 100% right. That's why they got all about that, Dick. Wonderful that you brought that up. Yes, because the filaments grew on the 6V6. That gets hot, that too, because the filaments did draw 6.3 volts at 450 mils, and Dick says most likely one of the higher drawing currents, filament currents, in that piece of equipment. Okay, all right, here's another one. Please help, help, help. Okay, what can we help you with? I was able to pick up several filters, IF filter circuits. I believe they're all used in commercial or amateur radio. However, the labels were removed. How can I get an ID? I know you guys did a lot of work with filters. How can I get an idea on these type of filters, what they are? Give me a way of getting a quick ballpark idea of what they are. Well, okay. IF filters and associated with them. You want to say a few words about it? I give you an idea of how you can basically find out what you got there. Over.
In the old radios of 1930 through 1970, I'm going to say, the IF strip had so-called IF cans. It was a rectangular aluminum can, about 7/10 of an inch square, and about 2 or 3 inches tall, with a slug down the center. And the majority of those in the old days on AM radios were at 455 kilohertz. And later on, when FM became popular, a similar looking can, a little bit more squatty, was 10.7 megacycles, was the IF frequency. Then came these ceramic filters that had all kinds of crazy shapes, and many of them looked a little bit like a ceramic disc capacitor. And those ceramic filters are a little bit more difficult to recognize, except for the markings on them. So that's a beginning of IF filters of AM and FM radios from my familiarity. K2KEY, K2RIW in the second half.
Okay, well, these alluding to like mechanical filters and all. And yes, Dick's 100% right. They surely branched out in the filter department. He does mention here, he says, I do have a signal generator, I have an oscilloscope, I got a frequency counter, and I got an RF voltmeter. I know you've done this, Mel. Tell me how to go about measuring, getting some characteristics of the filters. All right, well, that's an interesting question. I can tell you how to get in the ballpark, as they say, with the filters. And the mechanical filters, as Dick said, were very popular, pioneered by, of course, by the Collins Radio Company that held the patent on it for many, many years. And they went through a number of different designs, and they were mostly all 455 kilohertz type of filters. And then, as Dick said, they came up with then these ceramic types, etc., and so on and so forth, and had ones that were then all over the place, 10.7. I've seen them for even much higher frequencies and everything. I mean, so how would you go about finding out an unknown filter? What's characteristics, Dick? Over.
In the case of the IF can, which usually had 4 or 5 leads coming out of the bottom, there's a primary winding and a secondary winding. Your ohm meter on the times one scale will allow you to find the primary, which occasionally had a center tap, although sometimes the secondary could have the center tap. So the 2 or 3 leads that are on one winding and the 2 or so leads that are on the second winding, you can check them with an ohm meter. And then by grounding one of those input leads and feeding the signal generator to the other, and then putting your 2 probes of your oscilloscope across the other winding. In other words, you're exciting the primary and looking at the voltage on the secondary using your oscilloscope, and as you sweep the signal generator through the favorite frequencies, 455 kilohertz in the case of an AM transformer, you'll see a definite peak in response at around 455 kilohertz. You'll be putting out of your signal generator, let me pick a number, 0 dBm, which represents something like two-thirds of a volt, and you'll see something in the vicinity of two-thirds of a volt coming out of the secondary, that's RMS, and the peak voltage will be closer to half a volt or so on your oscilloscope if the IF transformer had 0 decibels of insertion loss. But as you sweep the signal generator, you'll see the spectrum, you'll see the oscilloscope respond when you're on the passband frequency of the IF can. Let me drop. So by doing that transfer test of applying a signal generator to two leads on one of the windings and applying the oscilloscope or AC voltmeter that goes up to that frequency on the secondary windings, and that would be a Hewlett-Packard 400 type AC meter, I'm a little bit worried now about whether or not Volcom milliammeters have good AC response as high as 455 KC. I think so, but it's not well calibrated up there. And then if you get no response, the next thing I would test would be 10.7 megacycles, plus or minus a little bit, and see if you get a response. That'll tell you if it's an IF can at the intended for FM receiver operation. All IF strips of AM radios were very close to 455 KC. FM radios were all at 10.7 megacycles, occasionally 21 megacycles, very rarely. And then when it comes to Collins mechanical filters, now again with your own meter, you probably can recognize input leads and output leads, but now the frequencies become a little bit more mysterious. I think some of the Collins mechanical filters ran at numbers like 8.9 megacycles. But you're more familiar with those than I am, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Commenting?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, you also might want to advise them about the green dot on the grid side, the output side of those cans on the 455s and the 10.7s. That'll also give them a direction.
Yeah, give us some words on that. The green dot, I think he was telling you which is the output side versus the input side. See, the actual square aluminum can, which is about, 7/8 of an inch square and about 2 or 3 inches high, when you plugged it into the chassis, because there are four wires coming out of the bottom minimum, and then usually two screws that went down into the chassis to mount it, you could mount it right side up or upside down. In other words, flipping the input and the output leads by mistake. You could do that when you're screwing it down to the chassis. And I think you're indicating, John, that the green dot told you which is the output side versus the input side to remove that ambiguity. That's a guess on my part. Let's see if you can confirm that one, John. KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, that's correct, Dick, because as you know, some of them just snapped in with like those little fan stock clips, but the green dot told you that side had to go to the grid circuit, the following tube. That was the easy way to do it, and you're right, but when I would test them, I would put the input signal on the grid side so that I could easily measure the output. It would be a little bit higher on the what would be the input to the transformer. Use that as the output. You get a better indication on the scope.
Very fine, John. So I think you're saying you recommend that during the testing procedure with signal generator and oscilloscope as the output indicating device, you would feed the transformer backwards from the normal operation. You would feed the grid side from the signal generator, and the plate side you would use to the oscilloscope. Also, the green dot, John, is the green dot on one of the four leads coming out of the bottom of the transformer, or was the green dot on the can itself? I'm a little bit fuzzy brain now because that was 30 years ago in my youth when I was doing that television and radio repair service, and I don't remember where the green dot was. Over to you, John.
Well, I'm sure as Mel could tell you, it was on. Usually, it was on only one pin to prevent the ambiguity of keeping that 180 degree displacement prop. But I'm sure Mel's very familiar with that testing.
You've got it, Mel.
Okay, like I say, here we go again.
Yes, I'll tell you the story on IF transformers. The ones that had color coding on them, if it had a blue dot, that meant it was the plate lead. If it had a red dot, that was the B-plus lead that went right to the supply. If it had a green dot, it went to the grid, or was known as the diode lead at the time. And if it had a black marking, that was the grid or the diode return, known as the return pin. That was the way it was laid out. Blue, red, green, and black. Now, if it had a center tap, it was green and black, like a little stripe they put on it. And that was used as the so-called, some of them had a center tap. That's the retinal system of IF. All right, but what this man talking about, he's got the mechanical filters, he's got the ceramics and all, and he'd like to get a ballpark idea. So the best way to determine, guys more or less gave him a, you know, outline of what to do. You take your signal generator, and if you have the RF, you have a RF voltmeter. Let me let it drop. Okay, put your signal generator on one side of the, in the mechanical filters. The Collins mechanical filters had a transducer on each side, so actually they could be worked either way, because the transducers on the, if it's the classic mechanical filter, was identical on both ends. And if you put a signal generator on it, put your RF voltmeter on the other side, and swish through, like fix at 455, whatever they had, quite a number of them, so I just go into them. They had 4 megahertz one. They had even, they produced an 8, something in the 8 branch military version. And, I mean, so and then there was the ceramic versions. There was, you know, crystal ladder filter types. I mean, there was a whole variety of filters that, of course, were being stuck in the receivers and everything like that. Some were in nice little cans, and some were all sort of in little rectangular enclosures. So I don't know what you have there, but if you put the signal generator Dixon, swish through it, you'll find someplace where it peaks. Well, let me tell you, let me drop it. Where it peaks, you get the exact peak. That is the usually the center frequency. Now, your RF voltmeter is calibrated in dB. You set the calibrator up, or your generator input, to read 0 dBs. Now, the next thing you want to do is now determine the bandwidth of this filter. Some of them could have been 500 hertz, 250 hertz, 1.5, 2.1 hertz, who knows? It was all bandwidth. Determine this now. You go from that peak, you go to the lower point, you move the generator off frequency, say, higher, you move it to a higher point where the meter now drops to a 3 dB point. You want to go to the 3 dB point where the meter reads 3 dBs, from 0 to 3 dBs. Now you go back, swish back to where it peaks, and now go to the lower frequency where it goes to 3 dB. So now you look at those two frequencies, because you have the frequency counter. You subtract those two frequencies, and that'll give you the approximate bandwidth of the filter. What do you think, Dick? Go ahead.
That's a very good technique, Mel, and that's measuring the so-called half power full bandwidth, 3 decibel bandwidth. So you find the lower skirt, 3 dB down from the peak response, and the upper frequency, sometimes called skirt, where it's 3 dB down, and the delta in those two frequencies tells you the 3 dB bandwidth. If you want to go further and measure the quality of the filter, if it is a crystal lattice filter, you might then go continuing all the way down until you find the 60 decibel skirt on the upper frequency and the 60 decibel down skirt on the lower frequency. 60 decibels down is a 1,000 to 1 voltage ratio. I should mention that If you're using a meter calibrated in decibels for your indicator, finding the 3 dB down point is fairly easy. If you're using an oscilloscope, the 3 dB down point is where the voltage is 71% of the center frequency, which you call 100%. So 70% of voltage, since power is a function of voltage squared, and you take the 70% and square it, you'll end up with 0.5, that's half power, that's 3 dB down. So you're looking for the 70% voltage number if you're using an oscilloscope and looking for 3 decibel bandwidth. And that the difference between the 3 decibel bandwidth and the 60 decibel bandwidth, sometimes they call it the 6 decibel bandwidth versus the 60 decibel, 6 versus 60 or 3 versus 60. They call that skirt selectivity factor. That's one way of determining the quality of the filter, if it is a crystal lattice filter or if it's a Collins mechanical filter. One more point, let me drop. And one other thing to worry about, Mel, is that if the leads are not easily marked as to which are the two input leads and the two output leads of a Collins mechanical filter, here I worry a little bit. Can they find those with an ohm meter? Is the input connector and the output connector of a Collins mechanical filter, is that a magnetic circuit where your ohm meter would measure a very small number of ohms? Or could it possibly be a piezoelectric or piezoelectric, I heard both pronunciations, where it's a crystal that is doing the excitation, and it might represent a nearly open circuit on an ohm meter, and therefore be a little bit more difficult to identify. So on these Collins mechanical filters, is it possible to recognize the input leads always with an ohm meter? You'll have to answer that one, Mel. I don't know. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Mel, the old classic mechanical filter, no. It had a transducer on each end. So it really didn't make a difference. It was, you know, a transducer on either end and these little vibrating, these discs. Very clever the way it was done, Dick. It, you know, it really was a work of art. Whoever dreamt that up, really, I mean, this guy must have been a musician or something. How the tune was, how did he come, how they came up with the concept was, I mean, magnificent. And you can imagine, this is going back a long, long time that they've, you know, had this on the market. And it's still a viable filter. Still see it, and the new equipment is still selling. Mechanical filters based on the Collins. I mean, they look a lot different than, you know, they've gone through a lot of engineering. But the concept has still been there. The classic, like I say, Collins filters, you do it either way. It made no difference whatsoever. They were, of course, all 455 original KC. KC, there I go, kilohertz. Okay, I better say kilohertz. Not kilocycles, but that was how they're marked, I should say. You know, you'll see them marked in kilocycles. That's the ones I mark. Unmarked ones, I could say, you'll have to do it with the generator. It'll give you a fact if you do it with the generator. And you see it at one, it'll come up one of the standard, almost, if you see something around 500 hertz, let me go drop that. It comes up like around 500 hertz, somewhere a little less, a little more, you can assume. And it's 455, I know that's the 0.5 hertz filter that went into the Collins. And it comes up 2 points, around 2, something like that, around the 2.1 filter for, that's the Collins one. There was another company that came up with a filter, very unique filter. I don't know if you ever heard of them. You may see them around because they started selling them and they were sticking them in a number of the receivers because Collins held the patent. So, you know, people are still working on making equipment and all. Some of the other manufacturers started using a filter made by a company called KVG. Are you familiar with that, Dick? Over.
Oh, KVG is a brand new one on email. I thought Collins was the only real respected name in mechanical filters. When you get a chance, Mel, I've never held a Collins mechanical filter in my hand. I think I've seen pictures of them. So describe a little. little bit what like the input leads and the output leads look like. And you told me it's a transducer, which could be piezoelectric. Therefore, you might not be able to identify it with your ohm meter as input leads and output leads. And when it comes to measuring the quality of your filter at 2.1 kilohertz, for instance, in other words, the upper frequency of 3 dB roll-off and the lower frequency might be 2.1 kilohertz apart, giving you that as a 3 dB bandwidth. And then if you go to the 60 decibel bandwidth, go a little bit higher up until the 60 dB down, a little bit lower down until the 60 dB down, the 60 decibel bandwidth might only be twice as far, 4.2 kilohertz. So there may be 4.2 kilohertz of 60 decibel bandwidth and 2.1 kilohertz of 3 decibel bandwidth, and that would be a 3 to 60 decibel bandwidth ratio of 2 to 1. And some of the quality filters had numbers like that, 2 to 1 quality factor on the 60 dB bandwidth versus the 3 dB bandwidth. So what did the actual filter look like when you held one in your hand, Mel? Where were the leads? How big was it? And so on. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, let's go by the ones I have, like, in my column, 7584 receiver. Picture about, let's say, a 60-amp cartridge fuse, Dick. That it looks like it snaps into an assembly, like you would snap in, you'd say, gee, I mean, they have people, you looked at it, and you didn't know any better, and say, my God, that's an awful heavy fuse for a receiver. Because it looks just like, you know, what they put in electrical boxes years ago before circuit breakers when they snapped in the big cartridge fuses. You know, do you remember what they looked like when they were like 60 or 80 amp cartridge fuses take over?
Yeah, those cartridge fuses, and my house has them. I think they're about, 5/8 of an inch, maybe 3/4 of an inch in diameter. A red round object, cylindrical object with copper end caps, and the thing is about 3 inches long. So my 60 ampere fuse for the range in my house, cartridge fuse, 3 inches long, 3/4 or so of an inch in diameter, red bodied object with copper caps on it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's it, okay. Now where the red body is, picture that as a metal body. That was what they looked like. That exactly what they looked like. They were just pieces like a cartridge. You snapped them in. In fact, they had a thing in the middle. The holder was, I'm sure you could put a cartridge fuse into the same holder. as I say, they're still around. So, you know, I think they did some really phenomenal work back in the day. All right, 10 o'clock. So I said we'll cut it off at 10, Dick. It's all yours. Let's continue.
Nowadays, Mel, if I was on the surplus market buying a Collins mechanical filter, make a rough guess as to how many dollars would be a reasonable selling price. Over to you, Mel.
No, I wouldn't know. I bet you they could go for a good buck. There were the standard ones. They had three filters that they had. They had, in other words, slots in like the Collins 7584 receiver, the 51J series receiver. All those receivers of that version of Collins had three slots, CW, an AM, that was the original pair, and then, of course, when sideband came along. So that was the three slots. I have seen that the Collins 7584 receivers makes a difference if you have the filters or not, don't have the filters, of making huge difference in prices, Dick, but I don't know how much over.
Okay, for the older Collins receiver that had an AM filter, a sideband filter, and a CW filter, I'm going to guess that the sideband filter was in the vicinity of 2.1 kilohertz bandwidth. I'm going to guess that the AM filter was in the vicinity of 5 or 6 kilohertz of bandwidth. I'm going to guess that the CW filter was in the vicinity of 500 hertz or 250 hertz of bandwidth. Are these the approximate numbers of those receivers, Mel? Go ahead.
Got it exactly. The 5